Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
If you live in Chico, you might know today's guest as a high school teacher and track coach, which he was for 10 years. But before that, David Brune served in the U.S. Navy. During his naval career, Commander Brune served on ships in the Persian Gulf. Ashore, he did tours at the Pentagon and an assignment to the Secretary of Defense staff at the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization in Washington, D.C. David Brune is a graduate of Chico State University and has master's degrees from the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School and U.S. Naval War College. He has authored 36 books, the majority on naval history, but also four about competitive running in the 1970s. Today I'm going to ask Commander Brune about his latest, and he says last, book, Sanctuary Not Certain. It's about a little-known subject, the Allied hospital ships in World War II. David Brune, welcome.
Thank you.
Do you know, your book has been a conversation starter for me because I found it so interesting. I wanted to know about friends of mine, people here in Chico, and I wanted to ask them, did you have anybody who was involved in World War II? And a lot of times they know something, but not very much. So there's where you come in. How can you help people learn more about maybe family members during World War II?
Well, Nancy's alluding to, I have a legacy website, davidbrune.com, and since this is my final book, I have more time on my hands, I'm offering my help in for people trying to learn more about the service of their relatives. So at my website, there's a contact tab. You know, people can send me queries about that.
Well, let me spell your last name for people who say, yeah, I'd like to know more about my uncle. David Brune is spelled B-R-U-H-N, davidbrune.com, and tap on the contact tab. Well, I mentioned that I really enjoyed talking to friends about this subject and family members, because this is, you titled your book Sanctuary Not Certain, but I thought of a couple of other titles. You might have called it The Unsung Heroes of World War II, or The Untold Story of World War II, because I didn't learn about this in my history books. And I started thinking, well, why did I not? Why were we not taught in school this? I have my idea about it, but why do you think, David?
Well, I'll bound the constraints of this book. This book is about Allied hospital ships in the Mediterranean in World War II. And 15 Allied ships, or not 15, 14 were sunk. None of them American, although American hospital ships were attacked. 13 Allied ships were purposely sunk by the German Luftwaffe. Actually, 12. The 13th was the Italian Air Force. And a 14th ship was sunk by a mine during the Normandy invasion. So you weren't, if you were a grievously wounded serviceman and made it to a hospital ship, you didn't find sanctuary necessarily. And American,
so that's your title,
right? American
Sanctuary, not certain.
American hospital ships were attacked in the Mediterranean, but none were sunk, none were lost.
Well, when I look at the cover of your book, this ship is not trying to hide. It has red crosses everywhere. I didn't even count how many there are on this ship, and so it was obvious which ships were hospital ships. Why don't you tell us what's on the cover of your book, David?
Well, it's a British ship that's being sunk off of Sicily. It was either Sicily or Salerno, and this particular ship was the one sunk by the Italian Air Force. And per the Geneva Convention, hospital ships were painted all white. They had a green stripe running the length of their hull. They had the red crosses, and they were lit up with lights at night. But there was a... after these attacks, I mean, there was a difference of opinion of military leaders. Should we light them up and have them serve as beacons for targets, or, you know, should we keep them dark, or should we light them up with the hopes that that would prevent them from being attacked?
So this cover, the crosses painted on that ship are prominent. There'd be no mistaking if the enemy saw a ship like that.
Right.
They'd know, no,
right.
This is a hospital ship. We're not going to attack this ship. Was that the case?
Well, obviously, they were attacking these ships because they were carrying soldiers who, the ones that were could get well enough, would go back into battle. So it was against the Geneva Convention. It was against law. It was against humanity. But the Allied ships that were sunk, the first one was Norwegian, the beginning of the war. The German Luftwaffe, then they sunk five Greek hospital ships and destroyed most of the Greek Navy. And the other seven ships were all British. And then the one that was sunk by a mine off Juno Beach was also a British ship.
Now, I mentioned the photograph that's on your cover, but one of the first things I did was to go through your book looking at all the photographs. You know the old, a picture's worth a thousand words.
Right.
So your book is really lots of thousands of words worth because of your photographs. They're black and white, and I just found myself staring at them. I'd never seen photographs like that. And also, you have maps. That is really helpful for me. Let's see. Where was Salerno and where was Oran? And so thank you for showing us these maps that, and you have arrows for the action, but I really appreciated that. So thank you for that.
Well, if I could return to your question about why people may not know about this, because a lot of the press was what was going on in the Pacific. So the U.S. entered the war in Europe with the invasion of North Africa in the fall of 1942. And then from there, they went to Sicily in Italy, then Salerno, then Anzio. And then the last operation involving these hospital ships was the invasion of southern France. Because the Normandy invasion was so big, which took place before the invasion of southern France, there's lots of press on that. So a lot of people do not realize what American forces were doing in the Mediterranean, what the Allies were doing in the Mediterranean, which was an incredibly dangerous place.
Well, I was surprised, too, that it wasn't until 1943 that we had our own hospital ships. So I was so impressed with the cooperation of the British and the Americans. That was lovely.
Yeah, when America entered the war following the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, the Navy had two hospital ships, both in the Pacific, and the Army had none. And Lieutenant General Eisenhower was in charge of the invasion of North Africa, and he started pounding the drum saying, we need hospital ships, and was angry at the Navy that the Navy wouldn't provide any. But because of the expanding front in the Pacific, all the large ships were functioning as troop ships. So they were taking troops. And so for the invasion of North Africa, wounded were coming back on the decks of American amphibious ships, and also the British helped us with that.
My guest is retired Commander David Brune. His book is Sanctuary Not Certain, and it's about the hospital ships. And you, on your cover, you say Eastern Theater in World War II. And I notice you spell theater the British way. And you have a note that I found amusing about the spelling of some of these words.
Well, the subtitle is American, British, Australian, Canadian Hospital Ships in the European, African, Middle East, Eastern Theater in World War II. So you had Canadian and British hospital ships in the Mediterranean. The New Zealand and Australian ones were in the Red Sea. They would go up the Suez Canal. And the Australians, as everybody knows, were fighting with the British in North Africa, Rommel's African Corps. And so they were taking the wounded out via that means.
Now, you've mentioned these ships and the Navy hospital ships and the Army hospital ships. I hadn't thought about the fact that it makes sense. They had different purposes. So why was the purpose difference in an Army hospital ship and a Navy hospital ship?
Well, the Navy ships were all in the Pacific. It was the theater was much larger, of course, and the Navy hospital ships had more capabilities than the Army ones. The Army ones, the U.S. Army ones, were basically going to the front, invasion points, taking the wounded off the beaches. They would lie offshore, and landing craft would bring the wounded out, and they'd bring them on board. And then they would take them to a rearward hospital, usually in North Africa, that wasn't that far away. So they were basically going back and forth. And eventually there was other hospital ships coming from America going to North Africa and taking them back home. and the British were doing a similar thing. The British were interesting because they had, the hospital ships were pretty much converted ocean liners and troop transports once they no longer needed them as troop transports. The British also had hospital ships that were basically cross-channel ferries. They were much smaller, so they were running across the English Channel, taking wounded out of France and running back. And during the invasion of Normandy, there were U.S. Army hospital people, doctors, nurses, and orderlies on those British hospital ships and hospital carriers. We had none for that invasion available, but they were on the British ships.
Well, people have heard of the Normandy invasion mostly, I think. But you mentioned the English Channel. Now, across from the English Channel is a French town called Dunkirk. And you cover that in your book, and I found that so fascinating. The numbers of people. What happened at Dunkirk?
Well, basically, the German army pushed the Allied army, mostly British, but there were Dutch and French, up against the shoreline, and they were going to drive them into the sea and annihilate them. So there's a movie that came out a few years ago called Dunkirk, and it shows private vessels coming across, Churchill calling on the people of England to save their sons. And it has all these little craft. In reality, the Royal Navy took off a whole bunch of that army, and so did hospital ships. But, of course, all the hundreds of small craft also took them off. There's a guy named C.H. Lightoller, who was the senior surviving officer on the Titanic, who after that was a naval officer and long retired. He was in his 70s. He took his 30-some foot yacht over there, and he took off. It was a huge amount. I don't remember the exact number, but it was like 150 soldiers packed them in there. And then at Dunkirk, they were fortunate that the cloud cover came in because German aircraft were bombing the vessels. And Lightoller said his son had told him that when the aircraft dropped their nose, they were going to bomb. So he was going hard left or hard right rudder to dodge the bombs. Kind of getting off subject here, but...
No,
that was Dunkirk.
But I found that really interesting, what happened at Dunkirk. Just the sheer numbers of people who were evacuated from Dunkirk was staggering.
Right.
Oh, my goodness. So I found that really interesting that you say that the popular impression is that there were all these little boats, which could get up closer to shore.
Right.
So they had that advantage. But you say also there were these larger vessels that were rescuing people.
Yeah, and the Royal Navy lost a lot of destroyers to German aircraft attacks in that operation.
Well, the way we got hospital ships was, the quickest way was to convert passenger liners. So what was the process of how converting a passenger liner to a hospital ship?
Well, Chapter 1 is devoted to that, and the information came from Australian New Zealand sources, and it was Australian New Zealand hospital ships, and it was provided by Commodore Hector Donohue, a retired one-star admiral, Royal Australian Navy, who's provided me lots of information for my books. But basically, they wanted a ship that had a fairly good turn of speed so they could do quick turnarounds, take the passengers, the wounded somewhere, and return and get more. And so they wanted a ship that was 14 knots or faster. And diesel-powered ships, which we call motor vessels and the Europeans called motor ships, those were ideal because they could use the water that cooled the jacket for the engines also to distill water. But one of the big things was they wanted a shallow draft as much as possible, considering that these ships were huge. They wanted to get as close to shore as possible. And they needed lots and lots of water. They needed like five times per person on board a hospital ship the amount of water as a normal ship. And then also they needed a lot more water for doing the laundry. So they had to have big tanks of water.
In fact, you give numbers. You say that they had to have 10 tons of water a day. So if they had 100 men, they'd have 10 tons a day of water. And then you mentioned 50 tons per week for laundry. And, of course, what about ventilation?
Yeah, ventilation, of course, was very important, and they needed air conditioning. And they talk about how they needed indirect lighting, and they had, of course, their surgical, they call them theaters, but that's where they did surgery. And they had a casting room where, of course, they put cast on people. Plaster room is what they called it. And then their wards, they had some where they had two-tier bunks and they had other single ones. And then they had the orthopedic patients separate. And they talk about how important it was moving patients within the ship that, you know, when they were off a shoreline where the fighting was going on and they could be attacked by aircraft or shelled by shore guns, they didn't want to spend a lot of time there. But it was actually slower getting the patients from deck down to where they needed to be in the ship than getting them on board the ship. And it was interesting how they'd get them on board the ship. The Army's first hospital ship, the Acadia, they used their chaplain. He was in charge of bringing the wounded on board. And they had a thing that looked like a box, shallow box, wooden box, where you could put two patients side by side. And they basically used a crane. So they lifted them out of the landing craft and they brought them on board. And, of course, they were doing that as fast as possible.
And you have photographs of the stretchers that were used to take men aboard.
One of the other things, of course, they needed a lot more lifeboats and stuff. And one of the things they had was...
Than a passenger liner.
Yeah, one of the things they had were called Charlie floats, which basically looked like giant inner tubes with netting. That was something the Commonwealth countries used, but those you could have a lot of them because they didn't take up a lot of space. So
I remember that term, Charlie floats. I also noticed you used the word draft, and maybe I enjoyed some of the naval terms you didn't explain. You just said, and the draft was shallow. So maybe people wonder what a draft was, and you used the American spelling.
No, I used the British spelling. Well,
yeah, I spelled it D-R-A-F-T. But use the British spelling. Yeah, what's draft? What is that?
The draft is basically from the bottom of your keel to the waterline. So, you know, if you have a 10-foot draft on a boat or something, then you can go into a certain depth of water safely. Oh, I should go back to, I use British spelling in here. As a nod to the Royal Navy did the heavy lifting in the Mediterranean. And I've had different Commonwealth friends help me with a lot of books. And it's funny because... You know, they take offense when it's not, you know, when it's not British spelling.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, in this case, you know, theater and draft and different things. And I have a little thing in the preface that shows the difference in the spelling. But it's a nod to our Royal Navy friends.
Yeah, I thought that was nice that you showed respect for the differences in British English, because the Brits were... I just really admired the cooperation between the Brits.
Yeah, my friend Rob Houle, who's a retired mine clearance diving officer and Royal Navy, he calls it English.
Yeah, not us. We Americans don't speak proper English.
Yeah, so the spelling I used in some of the words is English.
My guest is retired Naval Commander David Brune, and we're talking about his book, Sanctuary Not Certain, about hospital ships in World War II. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Chico author David Brune, and he has written a book about hospital ships in World War II. And I really think, too, your book is about nurses, for example, Army nurses. And there's so many times when the men, commanders, officers compliment the nurses. And what do they have to say about nurses?
Well, it's amazing. The Army nurses in World War II were all volunteers who were on the front lines in hospital ships. They didn't send them in harm's way. And I'll get to your question, but in the invasion of North Africa, The American Army nurses, they were taken over by a British transport ship. They went ashore in the assault craft with the assault forces because it was too dangerous for it to send a British hospital ship into port. So they divvied up the doctors, divvied up the nurses, divvied up the orderlies, divvied up the supplies. So they weren't all in, you know, in case they lost assault craft, you know, they wouldn't lose them all. And then once they got ashore, they went behind some hillsides that they were being shot at by snipers. And they initially went into some beach houses, and eventually they found an abandoned hospital. So that was kind of the entry of American nurses into the war. But let me read you something really quick. And actually, this, I'm going to try not to get emotional when I read this, because I've been in wartime conditions. This is a letter from Lieutenant Francis Slager. "Sure, we rough it, but compared to the way you men are taking it, we can't complain, nor do we feel that bouquets are due us. It is to you we doff our helmets. To every GI wearing the American uniform, for you we have the greatest admiration and respect." Slager was one of the Army nurses who signed a letter written to Stars and Stripes. 17 days later, on 21 October 1944, she died of wounds caused by the shelling of her tented hospital area in Belgium. So when that came out in Stars and Stripes, which was the military newspaper, this is, very emotional. This is one of the replies from hundreds of soldiers that replied to her letter. "To all Army nurses overseas, we men were not given the choice of working in the battlefield or the home front. We cannot take any credit for being here. We are here because we have to be. You are here because you felt you were needed. So when an injured man opens his eyes to see one of you concerned with his welfare, he can't but be overcome by the very thought that you are doing it because you want to endure whatever hardships you must to be where you can do us the most good."
Well, this reminds me of your dedication. So while you compose yourself, Commander, your dedication was special. And who did you dedicate your book to?
That's to my wife, Nancy. Well, to all military nurses, yep, past, present, and future. But there's a picture of my wife as a lieutenant junior grade 40 years ago.
In her uniform. Lovely picture of your wife in her uniform.
1985, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So this is really a tribute to nurses as other hospital personnel. So often nurses are described as they go into this without no panic. They're just focused on what they can do for these wounded men.
Yeah, that was their focus. And by the way, sorry for about getting emotional, but it happens a lot for people that have been in hospital environments in the service. Anyway, yeah, when the British cross-channel ferries were running back and forth, the hospital carriers, they were repeatedly bombed and attacked. And it's true, the nurses were focused on what they were doing. And they were kind of funny. So here's another thing that won't tear me up, but it's kind of funny. So
good.
There was nurses that were on a British hospital ship that was sunk, and they were in the water for several hours, and they were finally rescued, and they were taken ashore, and they were given men's clothing to replace their, you know, ruined clothing. And the head matron, all the Commonwealth countries, the nurses were nursing sisters. The British ones had army ranks, but she said, "Here, borrow my comb and try not to look like survivors." Guidance from a matron to her junior nursing sisters following several hours in the Mediterranean water, clinging to wreckage after their hospital ship was sunk and having been brought ashore in Iran, where their bedraggled uniforms were exchanged for men's clothing. So that's pretty funny. You get
so
up on shore and the senior year says, "Hey, comb your hair and try not to look like survivors."
Advice to the nurses.
Right, yeah. Right.
Well, something that there were a lot of things that surprised me that I did not know, things we were not taught in, say, high school or college history classes. And I was particularly interested in the Hague Peace Conference, and I've heard of that, but it was 1907, so I thought, well, how does that relate to World War II? How did that peace conference in The Hague in 1907 relate to World War II?
Well, that's when they had all sorts of things. You're not supposed to use mines, which the Germans violated. You're not supposed to use mines in certain areas. And that's where they had the stipulations in international law that you couldn't attack hospital ships provided they were painted in accordance with regulations.
Which these were.
Right, correct.
And they got
correct.
Bombed anyway.
Right, correct. So anyway, the Hague Convention established all this, and countries were following it. And that's one reason they had war crimes.
Well, another thing I thought was interesting is you talk about the naming of ships and why they use the same names more than once. And I thought, oh, well, what's that all about? So you have a paragraph in your book about the naming of ships, and I wonder if you'd read that paragraph.
The choosing of names for Army hospital ships was more important than it might appear, since each vessel had to be registered officially as to name and characteristics to be readily recognizable by the enemy. In addition, a serial number was also requited, which had to be prominently displayed on each vessel's hull. Once a name had been registered, any change had to be communicated to the enemy through the State Department and Swiss government. But separately from that, the American hospital ships originally, they'd take whatever the name of the ship was, if it was an ocean liner or whatever, and they'd convert it and they'd keep the name. But as the war went on and eventually the U.S. Army had 24 hospital ships, they started naming their ships for doctors and nurses
That's what you would expect.
That had been killed in combat and were courageous.
Yeah, yeah.
In tribute to them.
Well, speaking of tribute, a lot of times there's praise for nurses on the part of commanders. One says, as captain of this ship, I want to give expression of my admiration and deep regard for the nursing sisters on this ship. And he said, during our nurses were really splendid. Never a sign of excitement nor panic of any kind. They just carried on under the able leadership of our matron calmly and efficiently. And I feel quite sure that their magnificent behavior was an important factor in steadying up the members of the Royal Army Medical Corps, Royal meaning British, with whom they worked. So if they were doing so, of such outstanding work, they must have been rewarded for that in the form of medals?
Oh, yeah. I state in the book at near the end, more than 1,600 nurses were decorated for meritorious service and bravery under fire. Decorations included Distinguished Service Medal, Silver Star, Legion of Merit, Distinguished Flying Cross, Soldier's Medal, Bronze Star Medal, Purple Heart, Air Medal, and Army Commendation Medal. Of course, this is all theaters of war, not just the Mediterranean. But and part of this book focuses on hospital ships, but there were also hospital trains that were taking the wounded from the front to rearward hospitals, and there were also aircraft.
But now the only time I remember the trains were when they used Swiss trains to take the wounded to by train.
Well, that was return of POWs at the end of the war.
Oh yeah, that's right.
But they were I don't cover the trains in here, but anyway, so they had nurses, and then they had flight nurses that had wings. They earned wings. And so they were everywhere. And again, the nurses on the front lines were all volunteers.
Yeah. Yeah, so that is definitely admirable. Now, there were hospitals in the field, and I was surprised. You said that a field hospital could do 80 operations a day, 80 operations a day in these field hospitals. How was that possible?
Well, let me go over the Army patient care of evacuation. Now, you know, this I told Nancy early, a medical person. She really,
now, before you say, your wife is named Nancy.
Yeah.
So that Nancy.
Yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, a medical person should be talking about all this because, you know, I researched and wrote this, but, you know, it'd be more significant to them. But let me just go over this evacuation. This is from the front until ultimately where patients got home. Mobile field and evacuation hospitals, which closely followed the combat troops, were usually set up in tents, were subject to move at short notice. Nurses packed and unpacked hospitals each time they moved. Patients were brought to field hospitals by litter bearers and ambulance drivers. Doctors and nurses perform triage on arriving patients at the receiving tent to ascertain the severity of their condition. Those judged strong enough to travel were taken by ambulance to evacuation hospitals further away from the front lines and near transportation facilities. And that's where hospital ships got them, except they also got them off the beaches. Those who needed immediate care went directly into surgery. Others who needed surgery but were too weak for an immediate operation and could not travel were sent to the shock ward. Evacuation hospital doctors operated as necessary on patients sent from field hospitals. Where facilities were available, critically wounded patients needing specialized treatment were evacuated by air to station and general hospitals. Other patients were evacuated from the field to station and general hospitals via hospital trains, hospital ships, and aircraft attended by nurses and other medical personnel. Station hospitals received battle casualties from evacuation hospitals and performed surgery and specialized treatments. General hospitals were the last step in the evacuation line. Patients still requiring diagnosis, specialized lab tests, or long periods of recuperation and therapy were sent to general hospitals. Upon release, patients were either returned to duty or sent back to the U.S. This medical care was very extensive and very lengthy.
This is my guest, retired Commander David Brune, reading from his latest, and he says last, book, Sanctuary, Not Certain, about hospitals, military, naval, Army, Navy hospitals during World War II. Now, when you're reading this from your book, we are learning things that we didn't know before. Did you have a comment on what you just read there?
No, but one of the points I wanted to make was Navy ships were required to keep war diaries during World War II, so there was more information. These Army hospital ships were operated by the Merchant Marine, and there was no requirement. But the first U.S. Army hospital ship, the Acadia, Lieutenant Colonel Protzman was the senior surgeon, and he was the commanding officer of both the hospital unit on board and the ship itself. So what the Army did was they had a Merchant Marine master, but what they found was the Merchant Marine masters didn't always want to take their merchant ships in harm's way. That's kind of their culture. But these ships had to go in harm's way, so the senior surgeon was in charge. And Protzman kept a diary, which is very, very interesting, very, very valuable. I just wanted to read you one thing where he's talking about surgery. This is where they've departed the front and they're transiting in the Mediterranean and they're performing surgery. So they had male surgeons and then they had enlisted orderlies that worked for female nurses. And here he's talking about, we all worked through the night doing dressings or operating. It was so hot in the OR that my shoes filled with sweat at the end of each operation. We finally discarded the white operating gowns and stripped to the waist, dressed only in sterile gloves and trousers. Most of the cases were badly infected, so it really didn't make any difference what we wore. We lost one man during the night with a bad shrapnel wound in leg and thigh because he had gas gangrene. We had a great part of the work cleaned up and will probably be in bed by 0100 or 0200 next morning, 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. The nurses have done a fantastic job. All the wounded have been bathed and cleaned, their dressings changed or made ready for the operating room.
This is retired Naval Commander David Brune, and he's reading from his most recent book, Sanctuary Not Certain, about hospital ships in World War II. After a break, Commander Brune and I will be back to continue our conversation about his book, Sanctuary Not Certain. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with today's guest, retired Naval Commander David Broon, whose book is about hospital ships in World War II. Now, speaking of hospitals, in the thing you read before about field hospitals and general hospitals, so what was the, if I want to call it chronology, from a field hospital, and we're used to the term general hospital, but I never thought about why it was called general hospital. Why is that?
I guess because they could do a variety of things. The field hospitals were on the front lines, and so they did the immediate care. And then they just progressed through. And as mentioned previously, the worst, the most severely wounded, they would try to get them on aircraft and fly them out. So,
there's also on these different aircrafts, you mentioned a hybrid vessel. And what was a hybrid vessel?
I'm not sure. I know what you're referring to. So what happened originally where there weren't hospital ships, basically what they were doing was the Army and the Navy both were using military transports, troop transports, to take the troops out to the front.
Okay, so they start here in the United States, yeah. They start in America, and they're put on a troop ship. That troop ship heads off to—
Right. And the troops disembark and go off to war, and then they would load hospital patients and bring them back. But of course, you know, for troop birthing, you have them. They used to be six high berths, you know, high bunks. So you obviously can't have that on a hospital ship. So returning with patients back to the U.S., they had limited capability, and also the ships were painted gray. They weren't painted white like hospital ships. So after doing that for a little while, they figured out, okay, now we've got most of the troops there. Now we have some extra ships. We're going to turn them into hospital ships and paint them white.
You spend a good bit of ink on Acadia, a ship that you had an interesting history. And wasn't it one of these hybrid vessels that would take troops?
Well, initially. She first sailed in December of 1942, and they were going to North Africa. And then that went on for about 4 or 5 months, and then they converted it into a hospital ship, and then she was involved in the invasion of Sicily. So she was the first U.S. Army hospital ship.
And I might remind you're referring to a ship when you say she. I mean,
we're used
to that.
Right.
Instead, we might say it. So these ships were clearly marked, but there were still attacks on these Allied hospital ships. And how did they cope with that?
Well, before I get to that, I will say that I cover the attacks on all 13, air attacks on these 13 ships, and also the mine, the one that lost to a mine. It's all in this book. We're not discussing it here, but all the action. Well, basically, they lost a lot of wounded people. I'll tell the last story. So the last ship that was lost was a British ship during the Normandy invasion, struck a German mine. And British nurses on there, they were going below, as the ship was sinking, they were going below decks and bringing up patients, some of who'd lost limbs. They couldn't, you know, move on their own. And they're bringing them up on deck, and other nurses were helping get them into the water, into boats. Those two nurses that were going back and forth below decks, they went down with the ship. They lost their lives. The two that were up on deck, as the ship sunk, they slid down the starboard side. So that's just one example of the heroism of the nurses.
Of these nurses, yeah. And these Army hospital ships that came back to the United States, you say these hospital ships brought back hundreds of thousands of wounded servicemen.
Yes, over the course of the war, yes.
Hundreds of thousands.
Yep. Let me go back to a quick story. You ask how they coped. So one of the British ships was bombed by the Germans, and there was a nurse, and she was sharing a room with a couple other nurses. And, of course, the bombs knocked out the propulsion, knocked out the lights. The ship was sinking. And she said that she was laying on the we'd call it a deck. She was laying on the deck inside her stateroom, and there were timbers on top of her. And she thought, this is the end. I'm dead. And she laid there for a few seconds, and she goes, wait a minute. I'm okay. Let's get out of here. And then she said one of the women that she was sharing the stateroom with had a light or something, and there's holes ripped in, you know, you're in the dark and the ship's not on an even keel. And anyway, they got out. And so anyway, they were very brave.
Well, I want to remind listeners also of a service that you are offering, because you did a tremendous amount of research in this. I mean, just the photographs alone, a lot of research there. And you are offering to help anyone who wants to, or is trying to research themselves, family members or whatever they would like to know more about, that you have a website, davidbruhn.com. And Bruhn is spelled B-R-U-H-N. And type in davidbruhn.com, tap contact, and you will offer them advice, assistance for their research.
Yeah, I try to point them in the right direction. I'll tell one quick story. So over the years, I wrote a book for 28 years. People contact me periodically, and I'd help them if I could. I was contacted by a lawyer in Australia who'd been hired by family members. They wanted to know what had happened to their uncle during World War II. And it turns out I just read the report on that in a war diary. He was on an oiler that was hit by a kamikaze aircraft. And when the aircraft struck the ship and exploded, the blast propelled this gentleman over the side, and he was lost. And that word never made it back, I mean, to the family. So anyway, that was just one case where I was able to send him a copy of the report and help him out. So,
well, I might mention, you just mentioned the Pacific Theater, and your book focuses on the American, British, Australian, Canadian hospital ships in the European, African, Middle Eastern theater in World War II. So these stories that you tell are these stories that we probably did not hear about. And there's also a tribute to the Royal Navy, the British Navy, and British hospital ships in the Mediterranean. And they were helping us out before we even had hospital ships.
Yeah, that was true. And it was, you know, the old saying, any port in a storm. During the invasion of southern France, there were supposed to be 12 army ships. One couldn't make it, and so they replaced it with a navy ship. But it was interesting. They were supposed to take the wounded back to Naples, and the French wounded wanted to go to France. And, you know, basically, you know, if you're a wounded service person, you know, you probably don't care what ship you're on or who you're taking care of you. So there was a lot of help between the Allies, of course. So
my guest is retired Naval Commander David Bruhn. His latest book is Sanctuary Not Certain. And there were so many uncertainties during this war that the general public, I don't think, ever heard about. Now, one thing that we've heard a lot about, because there was a movie made about George Patton, and he comes up even in your book and is referred to. Now, Patton was not in the Navy, but it was referred to General Patton's Navy. Why did that expression come into being?
Well, because he had some ships assigned to him during the invasion of Sicily. But there's a great quote in here from General Patton, if I can thumb through it and find it real quick. So this is great. This is before America enters the war, the invasion of North Africa, and here's what he says. Never in history has the Navy landed an army at the planned time and place. If you land us anywhere within 50 miles of Fadala, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and within 1 week of D-Day, I'll go ahead and win. We shall attack for 60 days, and then if we have to, for 60 more. So, yeah, he's pretty funny. But he also—
And that sounds like General Patton, what we know about
him. He was also deeply religious, and we suffered relatively few casualties in the invasion of North Africa. And then he basically said Providence had helped us and called upon the Navy commanders to hold a special church service and, you know, have thanks for that.
And you just were mentioning North Africa, and maybe people are so aware of, say, Normandy, that they think of our involvement as starting in Europe, of course, in the Pacific, but our European involvement, maybe thinking, oh, France, but how did we really get involved?
Well, North Africa was because the Germans, of course, were fighting the Russians on the Eastern Front, and the Russians said, you know, we need the Allies to open a new front, or we're going to lose, and we're going to lose Russia. So the British were fighting Rommel in North Africa, and Rommel, they were worried that if Rommel took Egypt and the Suez Canal, there'd be no shipping coming through the Suez Canal. And the part that French North Africa were the Vichy French, which a lot of people don't know. The Vichy French were allied with Germany.
I think a lot
the
of
Vichy
do
French
know that.
Were not our friends. So it was a joint British and American attack in North Africa, invasion of North Africa. There were other allied countries there, of course, but that was our entry into the war. And then if you look at the map in the book, the American involvement was counterclockwise. From North Africa, it was the island of Sicily. Then it was Salerno on the Italian mainline. Then it was Anzio, where we lost. We had like 24 Congressional Medal of Honor winners at Anzio. I don't talk that a lot, but basically we landed the troops, and the Germans weren't aware, and the American commander general did not get the forces off the beach and gave time for the Germans to marshal their forces and come there and surround them. And Anzio was a disaster. And the idea for Anzio was to march on Rome and take Rome right away. And then, the last thing, there were other things, but the last big thing was the invasion of southern France.
And, when you talk about these places, I had a neighbor, he was old at the time, but he had been in Italy in World War II, and I wish I had asked him about his experiences. He had a heart attack many years ago, but so many things come up. Oh, I wish I'd asked my dad did not fight in World War II, but there's so many opportunities that I feel I missed that I could have maybe, they probably wouldn't have wanted to talk about it. Did you run into that?
Yeah, you run into that all the time. In fact, people that have served in the military, for the most part, unless you run into somebody else, you don't talk about your service. People say, thank you for your service.
Now they do. Today yeah. they do. Not soldiers coming back from Vietnam. Yeah. You better change out of your uniform before you get in that airport.
If you are truly interested, you want to engage somebody that was in the service, they will open up to you if they deduce that you're truly interested. They will talk to you.
Yeah. Well, you say this is your last book, but if this is, do you have any parting comments that you would like us to know that you learned for yourself? You must have learned a lot also, because we certainly did, we readers.
Well, I learned a lot. My books pretty much are all written from primary sources, war diaries and stuff. And the way I wrote my books is I would use primary sources and write them. And then when I was done, I'd go look at published works to fill in holes, things I didn't understand. And basically, in all my books, I want to pay tribute to unsung ships and their crews.
And that's what I appreciated about your book. Thank you for writing this book. Let me tell listeners again the title of your book. My guest has been retired Naval Commander David Brune. His latest book, and he says last, Sanctuary Not Certain, American, British, Australian, and Canadian Hospital Ships in the European, African, Middle Eastern Theater in World War II. Thank you, Commander.
You're welcome.
And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
What she wants. She wants to take the rocks out of his pockets, be the puzzle he keeps going back to, the clue that solves it. She wants to be the sweat on his neck, his holiday dinner with two kinds of stuffing, the bandage across his chest that stops the bleeding, the wax he drips on his other girlfriend's belly, the breeze through his window, the butter he licks from the corners of his mouth, the only kiss lingering on his lips, the milk in his coffee, the recurring dream he waits for, book he gets lost in, kitten he rescues from the alley. She wants to be his last meal before they flip the switch, and she wants to be the one that pulls him out of the chair, the shoes he wears to escape, the song he sings as they're running. Kim Dower.
The Crossword Puzzle, Mark Malinger. The empty square stares up at me, daring me to put in letters. Any letters would do. In an empty crossword puzzle, it all seems correct. The empty boxes are non-judgmental. They shout, sure, put in the wrong letters. We don't care. A six-letter word for trilbies. Never heard of trilbies before. But a five-letter word for courtroom procedure, followed by a sticky street covering, seven letters. The pen taps nervously, as if by some magical incantation it can summon the correct answers. Google would help. Google is always awake. Google and I are friends. But is that cheating? Will it allow me to feel success? Can I Google ethics of using Google to solve crossword puzzles? I'd hate to have Google mad at me. I'd love to awaken my sleeping Pammy and show her the completed puzzle. Done by me, no help, no hints. I'd hear a soft, good. It's 11:45. And as I will crumple up and throw away the puzzles in the morning, only I would know that I didn't complete it all on my own. Would Google tell? Nah. Collective remembrance, five letters. Stuck again. Blanks, smiling up. The pen tapping intensifies. Please stop the clicking. More of a statement than a request. I'm not clicking. I'm thinking. Tapping helps me think. But the tapping wakes me up. Well, as long as you're awake, what's a five-letter word for collective remembrance? I don't know. Try memory? No. That's six letters. I'm looking for five. Silence greets me again. The cat jumps down from the bed, telling us that she too has had enough. Five letters, remembrance, collective remembrance. Think more quietly, please, or move on to the next clue. Oh, sorry. I sound frustrated with an apologetic spin. Sure, next one down is five letters, a military cheer. At this point, silence is my ally. The blanks are adding up, more empties than filled in. She sounded pretty alert to me to have been bothered by a tapping pen. Best not to antagonize her, as I remember the innocuous mosquito is the deadliest animal there is, a million deaths a year. I saw it on Google. Best to keep quiet about her being awake. Again, silence envelops me. The unconscious tapping begins again. Please comes across at me like a thrown brick, not like a gentle request. Sorry, I say again, and I continue to rack my brain for anything which would help. A native of a state, seven letters. At 1:15 a.m., I finally click the pen onto the page I was working on, stare once more at the blank crossword puzzle squares, push my glasses, pen and paper, and headlamp over the side of the bed like an avalanche, and hear them clatter and lay quietly on the throw rug. Only the silence of the cat jumping back onto the bed to lay between us keeps us company. And I wonder, maybe a dot-to-dot book would be better. At least I would not disrupt the whole house. Mark Malinger.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.